So I wanted to explain a few things in a simple way about the work I've been doing with Veronica on holography. So first we were looking at holographic QCD models and then holographic Technicolor models, which has some very, very close relations to XS models that people are doing here. And the point is that doing this, we've learned a few ways of doing things differently, which give insight into the 5D model building. So this is the few things I want to explain. And so some of them are tricks that I won't describe in detail, I'll just give the idea. But the point is that they really allow you to get insight into the model because you understand deeper, well, you understand better the relation with 4D models. So, right. So the main point, if you want, of the talk is that if you want to look at low energies at physical quantities, that they are going to be 4D quantities in the 4D low energy theory, and these essentially come from contributions of all Kaluza-Klein resonances, some contributions from all Kaluza-Klein resonances. So you would do that computation by performing the KK decomposition, diagonalizing the equations of motion, etc., using the boundary conditions and solving the boundary value problem, and you would end up with the result. But for all these three-level quantities, it's much easier if you have a shortcut. And this shortcut is, in fact, noticing that in the end, all these quantities are just some geometrical integrals over the bulk, so over the fifth dimension of the warp factor that I call W. So, in fact, in the end, you don't even bother with this step, and you just go directly from here to here. And this is supposed to be simpler and to help you understanding what's going on. So the point is that then you can do it generally for whatever metric. You don't have to rely on flat space or ADS. And you can study then fancy things like we've heard last week of introducing deviations from ADS. But I won't go into numerical computations. So in fact, I'll take the simple case of Young-Mills fields in the bulk, because then it's simpler for me for the moment. I don't have any mass terms, so it's the simplest case. And I will assume that the symmetry breaking is done by boundary conditions, so it's really like Higgs-less, because this is simpler for here. But you can extend it. Just to illustrate the technique, I'll stick to that. So there's no bulk scalar that breaks the symmetry, so it's done by the infrared boundary conditions. So I want to give you the notations. So the fifth dimension will be an interval. The variable z goes from L0 to L1, L0 being what I call the UV brain, and while the L1 the infrared brain. I'm going to consider only conformally flat metrics, meaning that I can always rewrite the space-time interval as flat up to a factor. The factor is the warp factor W that I've introduced. And then the rest is just flat, so Minkowski. I hope you can read my handwriting. If not, right. So in this notation, ADS is corresponds to a warp factor given that was like 1 over z, and flat space is W equals 1. So for holographic QCD, what was the idea? The idea is to describe the spin one mesons, for this first step, at least just the spin one mesons, as Kaluza-Klein excitations of a 5D field. So since these mesons, rho, L1, rho prime, etc., live in multiplets of the vector SUNF global symmetry that remains in QCD, where NF is a number of massless quark players. So I need some SUNF field. So let's say if NF is 2, I need triplets in the bulk, and all the excitations will be these Kaluza-Klein that I will identify with the rho A1, etc. So in fact, I know that these fields are either called vector and axial for their transformation properties, and that they come from the breaking of this SUNF, cross SUNF to the vector subgroup. So I'm just going to put 5D units in the bulk of with the group being SUNF cross SUNF, but now 5D engaged. Anyway, we'll see how it works.
So now I'm starting. This is the first introduction in a sense. Right, so I don't know if I need to, what I write the language. So the action then is some prefactor, whatever. Then I integrate over the usual four coordinates. The fifth one goes from L0 to L1. I have the 5D gauge coupling that is dimensionful now. And I already pull out all the curvature of the space and write everything with Minkowski eta nil or eta n. And then I have left, I call them left-handed, even though there's no karaite at this stage, gauge, it's left-handed gauge fields, plus the same for right-handed. And then I take, this means trace in the flavor space. So that's just the Lagrangian. And I have to specify the boundary conditions. So in infrared, the boundary conditions have to break this to the vector subgroup. And I just impose that the difference, so on the infrared brain, of these two connections is zero, meaning that now I cannot perform there the whole SUNF cross SUNF transformations without competing with this condition. So I've restricted the transformations to only the vector subgroup there. And I have a condition that doesn't break my vector subgroup, so I can write something like that. And then pick gauges to work to compute. But I won't even need this equation for what I'm going to expect. Right, so if I do this, so I just have one bound, I have two sets of fields, each one has, or two combinations of them have boundary conditions. That's still not enough to solve everything. I need to specify boundary conditions, and they're going to be boundary conditions in the UV. So these ones were in the infrared, so in L1, and they're the ones that break the symmetry by boundary condition as in Higgs. So what else do I need? So if I look at what I'm going to use, the vector and axiom combinations of these left and right fields with some normalization. I'm not going to use that. And if I look at, say, the vector combination, and I plug back the equations of motions that come out of this, I end up, in fact, having that the action is just a boundary term, so the prefactor will stay there. And I have just something like that. So these two terms are the two boundaries, at quadratical and the quadratic level.
Where did that come from? Last sentence again?
So if I have the action, and if I use the equation of motion, the action vanishes on the solution, essentially. That's just what I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
Except maybe for boundary terms. So I'm looking at these boundary terms to know how to specify the model.
Okay,
it's just
gotcha.
That. So, well, this essentially, if I choose my definitions well, or if I pick the right gauge, I see that it makes this term vanish, because this is d5 v nu is the same thing as this, essentially. So that's fine. And then I probably want this to vanish. And what I can do, of course, is asking that the fields vanish on the UV brain. And that's what I'm going to do. But in fact, you can use a trick and not set them quite to zero, but keep them as external fields, as sources. Because then you realize that if you set them to a fixed value that you don't integrate over, it means that you still have a global symmetry there. And that's the point. That's my global symmetry of QCD. So the SUNF cross SUNF of QCD, the 4D global one, is just my Young-Wills transformations on the UV brain. But I cannot make local anymore because I impose boundary conditions. So what's the point of keeping the source and not just setting this to zero here, is that then I can work and take the functional derivative with respect to these sources, let's say. And this by definition is going to be my currents. So if I define currents like this, then I can define charges, and the charges are going to obey current algebra. Which is exactly what I want to say, that I'm discussing a theory that has, well, a model that has an SUNF cross SUNF global symmetry. So I just to summarize, I try to tell you that I'm essentially playing with the boundary conditions to identify what are the symmetries and impose the symmetry breaking. In infrared, you impose the symmetry breaking, and in the UV, you identify the currents.
And you can, of course, show that
then you have the right symmetries. This doesn't erase very well. Right, so why did I bother giving the expression of the currents? Well, because to help you identify what's going on, this, if I'm thinking of modeling to see, this is identifying with these quad bilinears that are the currents. And for the axial combination, there would be a gamma type somewhere, where TA and my generators of SU and F, and Q fields are the quad fields that are nowhere in the modeling, but if you want to think of what could be the 4D description, what 4D model I'm describing here, it has, for instance, could have these kind of currents. And that's the hope that this 5D model can describe features of QC. So, right, that was about symmetries. Now I want to discuss the parameters. So,
I want to ask you, this TA is the diagonal component.
Well, it's just the generators of SU and F.
The diagonal one. Both of them.
Well, either of them, depending whether I put gamma 5, it's the vector or axial combination. So to make the connections of parameters, I want to say I have the two positions of the two grains and the 5D gauge coupling for the moment. And of course, if I take metrics, that is for me just the wall factors, let's say, what I've written, that are complicated, they can have additional parameters. But for the moment, I'm not introducing that. Okay, so we can identify one combination of parameters by looking now precisely at these correlators of these currents. So if I look at this, it will only be non-zero if the two Clavier indices are the same. Then I can extract the Lorentz structure of this. And that just comes from the fact, well, from what identities, so I know that I'm going to be able to factor it, but the Wall identities are going to be preserved because I have the right symmetry. And then the two-point function that I call by this. And I can first look in QCD what it should be. I'm just looking at the correlator between two currents. So there's exchange of quarks at first order, and then there are corrections between gluons that I'm not going to mention, I think, probably. And just this gives you that this two-point function in the deep Euclidean, where you can compute it, is some factor of NC, because the flavor is fixed, but all colors of quarks can run around the loop. Some normalization. And it starts essentially with a log. It's just a simple loop. There's nothing. And then there will be corrections in alpha S and non-perturbative corrections that I don't want to discuss too much here. So there's some renormalization scale that has come here. And now if I look at the same object, the same correlator with my definition of the current before in the 5D model, and I compute, well, I can find a similar expression provided that my warp factor is essentially ADS plus corrections, where these corrections vanish when Z goes to 0. Okay. So it's ADS near the UV brain. And then I find the same thing. I find that the two-point function is this ratio and the same log, where the scale is replaced by the position of the UV brain. So
those extra corrections are required or not to get the log in the one plus dot dot dot?
No. If I okay.
What happens?
So if I don't,
do they change?
If I put exactly this,
yes,
I get this plus some exponentially small corrections.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And if I put corrections, I can put the corrections that give me the leading alpha is corrections. I can put corrections that give me leading OPE corrections, 1 over Q to some power,
yeah,
as we discussed a bit last. So I can put them, but. Right, so now I can, if I want this to really describe the same magnitude here, QCD, I can already match this combination with that. And in fact, apart from that, L0, so the position of the UV brain, is not going to appear except for describing the renormalization point. But I can take L0 to infinity, essentially. Yeah, to zero. So I only have two parameters. I have this, which is essentially NC. And I have the position of the infrared brain, which is going to give me the scale, the mass scale for the resonance, for the gravity. So it tells me the confinement. And what it gives, as you can expect, is that the masses of these guys is proportional to 1 over N1 squared. And in fact, one of the things that we learned is that you can do this independently of the metric now. So I was talking here about ADS plus deviations, precisely if you wanted to introduce whatever deviations to reproduce more terms in the expansion of this to match it to QCD. Well, you can still compute for ADS. And if you want to compute the mass of each Kaluza-Klein, you'll have to diagonalize the equation, the wave equations with the boundary conditions and solve this boundary value problem. But if you want some quantities that involve all Kaluza-Kleins, there are always some shortcuts that you can find. So I'm done with this. And now I want to discuss the resonances, and I want to provide one example of a shortcut that shows you that you can compute things independently of the metric. So
I'm trying to understand one connection here. In the Randall-Sundrum model,
yeah,
the KK resonance spectrum depends in part on the curvature over M Planck. Is that contained in this?
Oh, right, but I've already sent L0 to 0. So that's probably what you think of as the Planck scale while the inverse is. So I get rid of this because I'm just talking about QCD and no.
So you're in the limit where the curvature is very small or something.
Yeah, well, very long. So under the curvature radius, it's very small. But okay, I can do the computation I'm going to do now, keeping L0 if you want. And I'll need to do that for the second part of technical. So what I can compute easily is the sum of all these inverses.
Yeah,
sorry,
let me just make sure I got this straight. So in terms of the constant K that's normally called the curvature over M Planck, K is going to 0. Or M Planck is going to infinity, or what?
K is going to infinity.
K is going to infinity. Mm. I see. Okay, now I've got
it. So K is 1 over 0.
Okay.
You're thinking of writing it like this, and I write it. So I can compute this. And the point is that if I want to compute, I guess, the sum over all Kaluza-Kleins, I should set a start with an object that involves all of them. And of course, one obvious object that involves all of them is the 5D propagator. And precisely the point is that rather than using the expression of the propagator as a sum of contributions of all the Kaluza-Kleins, which is written like this, I can work directly on this. So this tells you how each Kaluza-Klein propagates with its wave function that you could try to extract. And for momentum P, that's the expression, and the two are the same, if I've defined this right. And what this propagator has to obey is, maybe I should start first saying how I should find the wave functions and the masses. In principle, you should solve if the equation should look like this. With the right boundary conditions. This plus the boundary conditions that you derive from what I've explained before. So the boundary conditions that I've input on the 5D field give you boundary conditions on each of the wave functions of the Kaluza-Klein decomposition. So, well, I don't know, is it clear for you what I mean by Kaluza-Klein decomposition? I'm saying that rather than looking at my, let's say, axial combination of gauge fields that depends on the first four coordinates and the fifth, I will make a decomposition into eigenmodes labeled by an N
that depend only on the first four coordinates, but now there's an infinite number of such terms. And each has a wave function that depends only on z. So I'm looking for these wave functions. Right, so you would have to solve this. And in parallel, this propagator solves a similar equation, except with the delta function, because it's a propagator. And the equation would be like this with the delta function. So g now depends on z and z prime. So these derivatives are always with respect to z. There should be z's everywhere, but I'm going to skip them. And you should normalize things, so the 5D gauge coupling is going to appear. And you probably are going to have one power of the wall factor appearing here, but I'm not interested in it. So it's a it's the same equation, essentially, with p squared replacing m squared, and with a delta function on the other side. Okay. So the point is that if I take this at p equals 0, I can see something that may look like my sum a little bit, provided I get rid of what's on top. And what's on top I can get rid easily by taking the integral rho w over the space, multiplied always by the wall factor, it always has to be here, and taking coinciding points. Because then I can use the orthogonality of wave functions, and each of these terms gives me one. Okay. So to get this, I just have to play with this equation. I don't know if it's useful to do it here. But essentially, I've taken it at p squared equals 0, so I can get rid of that. So I just have a second derivative of g equal to a delta function. I can integrate this twice. And g is going to be some double integral, like this. And you have to find out how to match the ordered W variables in this. I'm not going to bother. It depends precisely on the boundary condition, so on which thing you can. So just to show you that the point is, if I ask a question about a quantity that involves all Kaluza-like lines, I should look at an object that is more coming from 5D, like the 5D propagator, that already includes all contributions together. And if I use some tricks, I can always find an expression at low energies. That's the point. I had to look at an expansion at p squared equals 0. Here, I even set p squared equals 0 to get the result. And I'm going to find that this sum is then this integrated. So the delta function is going to disappear. So I'm going to find that this is equal to, I have this integral here, let's face this one. And the last with the delta function is going to disappear. So I get some term like this, where again, to find how to combine the dummy variables, you have to look precisely at the boundary conditions. Okay. You can always get this result, and you can compute it, and of course it gives you a result that looks like L1 squared, telling you that the scale of this Kaluza line is given by the infrared ray. So this is not a big result, but it can be very useful for what I want to do afterwards. So, okay, forget now about the trick, as well, just to show you that it's not very difficult. The result is always like this. If I want to contribute a sum of contributions from Kaluza lines, I can always use 5D quantities. And there, rather than a sum over Kaluza-like line, I'm going to find an integral over the fifth dimension. And it's going to be, no other parameters are going to come in. So these integrals are going to contain the geometry that is here, just the powers of the wall factor. And it's going to be multiple integrals. That's not very interesting, but you will always be able to find such expressions. Right. So what do I want to do with these expressions? So this one is giving you the sum of the inverse of the masses. I will use it afterwards, but let's assume that you're interested in trying to find the contribution of Kaluza-like and to four fermion operators, and that you had some interactions between the four fermions that were given like this. So some fermion being here, time the wave function of each Kaluza-like line, then you could derive a similar equation. So I could call this Gn proportional to this. Then the sum of all coupling squared over the masses squared is going to give you the effect at low energies. So the four fermion interaction due to the exchange of all Kaluza-like lines. And again, it's going to be some multiple integral. In general, there'll be some function that tells you the shape, the wave function of this bilinear. So it's going to be something. Triple integral this time, where f, so this function of the Fermi bilinear is going to appear twice. So you can always compute whatever the metric is. Right. So what I haven't said, and I should have said, is that since these equations will be solved paying attention to the boundary conditions, and since the boundary conditions that I've chosen split are diagonalized if you look at the vector and axial combinations of gauge fields, what you get is axial and vector resonances.
Okay?
So it's the spectrum is really split in vector and axial resonances, the vectors being the rho and its excitations, and the axial is the A1 and its excitations. Now there's another mode in the spectrum, and that another multiplet, these are the pions. So that's what I want to describe next. I hope I haven't confused you too much. What is different?
The covering of the different GN is different?
Yeah, because it's going to be always given by. What I'm saying is that there will be some term in the Lagrangian that involves the 5D fields. And when I don't decompose it, I will find that the coupling of each Kazakhstan is given by some.
Different
N?
Yeah.
All right, so I should sum, sorry, I should sum over all N.
You already
summed it, sampled the less. No. I cannot use this one here because now it's a more complicated expression. I have to do it for each expression. But sorry, I don't want to confuse you too much with this. I just wanted to show you that it can be done in a few lines, but I don't want to you to follow this. It was just sure it's in fact simple enough if you sit down. And that you can do it for any of these quantities. And now forget about it. I'm going to go back to more physical questions. But I'm happy to use the result, so I assume that we know how to do it.
So basically what they are doing up to now is to use the 5D propagator instead.
Yeah, you can do it. Because you're looking at what's the effect at low energies of Kazakhstan exchange, and you can sum it up as the effect of the 5D propagator at low energies. So that's why I could use this in solving it by setting P squared equals 0 in the 5D propagator. It's just because this 5D propagator already is a compact form from. And I don't
include all the effect of the effect of all the
colors. So the point is that I don't have to solve for the propagator to get the effect. I can use its equation. I erased it, but okay. It's defining equation with about, and I assume that, well, I don't need to solve it. I know the equation that defines it and the boundary conditions. And if I try to see what would be the effect at low energies, I don't need in fact to solve for it. At the end, what remains is just some double integral that I can obtain just by knowing what the propagator has to satisfy. I don't have to solve for it. That's the point. So then I don't need to solve for anything in the depending on the metric. I can do it in whatever metric because the result in the end is just that.
But the propagator would depend on the metric.
Yeah, it would, but I don't need to solve for it because I can spit out the result without actually solving for it.
You can do it in any case or in some very specific case?
No. So this is... Well, so that's, let's say for this one, that's the expression
that's a specific
in any case. Well, any quantity that is quadratic, that is related to some quadratic exchange of Kazakh lines, let's say. And
I guess maybe three-level you can...
Yeah.
When there is a propagator.
Yeah, maybe you can use some of these things that one, but we didn't...
Well.
Right, so forget about this. The business of obtaining it. Just to be that it's simple enough to do it. Then, I have to describe the rest of the spectrum. It's just the pions. So, for the moment, I haven't given details of the gauge choices and etc. But I've only discussed the Kazakh lines of the first. Four components of each gauge field. The point is that you can choose a gauge where V5 vanishes, and you would also want to set A5 to vanish to make things simple, but you cannot do that because you cannot gauge away this component, essentially because there's a Wilson line, so you have the UV brain and the infrared brain. Here you've identified left and right. So this would be, let's say, left gauge fields and right gauge fields. Here you've identified them. And here you've forbidden any gauge transformations on them because I've set
I've broken the symmetry here to the global one, so I cannot make transformation. So the Wilson line that goes with one of them to this end and goes back with the other one is an object that doesn't transform on the local symmetries. And it's where I can write it. So it's a path integral, exponential of integral from L0 to L1, five, L5. And then the integral the other way around of with the other. So it's now strictly A5. If you want to do it covariantly, that's the expression. And this I would call U, it's a unitary matrix. And it has something to do with the pion, and it's our to explain it. Well, it has the right transformation properties to be the pion because it just transformed under the global symmetry. So the symmetry, the left SUN that is here and the right SUN that is here, it just transforms as the pion. So this tells you that it's probably the pion. And the point is that you can extract the pion kinetic term that is just going to be the trace of this linear cross with a prefactor that I'm going to call the pion decay constant. And how you extract this? Well, this comes from the only term that has, and this is the law of F5. So it's going to come from the A5 mu term, if you want for short. So this is the integral. There will be a wave factor. And what it gives is that, in fact, there should be some wave function, in fact, for this pion, for this term as well. And this wave function I'm going to call alpha.
So is this something that was contained in your original?
Yeah, it is contained in the Hermite Lagrangian that I started
but
with.
But then I got confused because I thought you set up the boundary so that the action vanished.
Right, but in fact, I just wrote for the mu. I didn't even specify for the fifth component. But I don't have to. With the boundary conditions that I specified, I always have this Wilson line that is invariant. So I always have a mode like this that I cannot gauge away. And I can always prove that it's a set of massless or a massless multiplet. And
so what was wrong with your argument, though, that the action was zero? You say this is somehow...
Oh, well, the action is always zero on the solution. This, whatever the fields are, if I plug the equations of motion back in the action, I find zero.
Right, so how do you manage to isolate a non-zero component of the action? I'm still confused on that.
Sorry, what's the...
You say this came from your action, this thing on the right.
Right. Oh, right, but now I'm not using the... Right.
So
I was using this result... just to explain how to extract currents and then to look at two-point functions. So for this, I was using evaluating the action on its solution, plugging back the solution in the action. But now I'm looking at the modes in general, so I'm not using the fact that the modes solve the equations of motion. Otherwise, I cannot find the modes. Otherwise, everything is equal.
Oh, I see.
I'm not doing Feynman diagrams.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, yes, each mode would solve itself. I'm going to keep this short. So there's some. This is going to give you the term that I've written about here, and it's going to give you this term. And in a computation, you have to realize that there's some wave function that appears somewhere. That is, I'm going to call alpha. That is a massless mode, and it's going to be related to the wave function of the pion. And if you look at how to solve the system, you're going to find that alpha, so that's the wave equation, but I still need the boundary conditions. And alpha is going to be, well, it could be a constant, or it could be, so there are two independent solutions to this, are a constant, and is also there's the other one, which is alpha equals the integral of 1 over omega. So a solution that has the derivative of alpha proportional to 1 over omega. And if I pay attention to my boundary conditions in solving this problem, I'm going to define the integral of 1 over omega from z to the infrared brain divided by the total integral of 1 over w. So some solution, whatever. What I mean is that I can solve explicitly for this mode. Okay. Okay, if you look at the details, you will see that in flat space, what really gives you the wave function of the pion is in fact a flat mode, which is a bit maybe weird. But in AES, or in warp space, the wave function is more localized in infrared, which is what you expect, because this is the pion that is related to the symmetry breaking, so it makes more sense that it's localized in infrared. So again, we see that metrics that are warped seem to describe a bit better what happens in QCD. So we had before the identification with a two-point function of these currents, which worked in ADS plus corrections. And here I don't derive it for you, but this pion should be an infrared object. And it is if you're not in flat space, but in warped space. Right, so I just introduced that to tell you that I can compute the pion decay constant. I can find the pion wave function in any metric. So that's going to be useful because now I want to move to holographic technical.
So what's the Uni brain, the IR brain, the boundary condition setting to deal with what is that?
Sorry, I didn't mean.
The Wilson line?
Yeah.
Do not include the boundary command.
Do not include the boundary?
Wilson line, I don't do it. Wilson line, there is two paths in the boundary.
Yeah.
Setting to zero.
Did I do? Sorry, I can't hear.
The
Wilson
line you.
Yeah.
You only include the path in the book.
Yeah.
What about the
Well, I mean, it doesn't matter because the relation, but I can. Well, I don't think it changes. Well, we also did then a detailed thing where we include the fields on the brain. And you can still define this. Then if I want to write it in that case, maybe I have to write some additional bit that will be the real invariant. So, right. So if you want, here I just set finally a boundary condition on the infrared.
Yeah, for the UV
brain. For the UV brain.
No, this is. I mean, this is invariant under the right symmetries, and there's no additional term. No, this is fine.
What sets the mass of the pion? What?
Well, it's zero because it's related to. I mean, it's, you cannot build a mass sum for this unitary matrix in the end. That's just this, if you want. Because it has, I mean, because it's a unitary matrix that sits there because of the symmetries, because it transforms under the global symmetry that you've kept, and you cannot build a mass sum for this. For the same reasons that if you start building a Lagrangian for the pion itself and impose the symmetry, you can write it down the mass term.
Yes.
You would have to break the symmetry explicitly.
Yeah, right.
And you can do that afterwards if you want to. So, well, I don't know, we can look deeper after. Maybe. Right, so for technical, what do I want to do? I want to couple, essentially SU2 plus U1. To the conserved currents of strong interacting models. So I can take this model of strong interactions in 5D and couple these fields to its current. And this is done again by looking at this term that I had on the boundary. And before I told you that if I just want to keep the global symmetry, I was setting this to zero on the UV brain. And now I can pick the other boundary condition that leaves a set of field non-zero on the UV brain. So I set now d5, the derivative equals to zero. So that's a plus boundary condition for the subgroup SU2 plus U1 of my starting group, which would be in that case SU2 left, this is hypercharge. So we start with a Lagrangian that has an SU2 cross SU2 cross U1 B minus L 5D angles. Symmetry. I will impose the same kind of breaking in infrared, but now some of the conditions on the UV are going to be changed so that I keep a set of gauge fields S2 cross U1 coupled to the currents that I had extracted before. So I do this by changing the boundary condition. Now the point is that this, obviously, if I change the boundary conditions, I risk that all the spectrum, I have to redo all the diagonalization again, and I cannot keep any of the results of before. And this looks bad because if I think of what I expect in Technicolor, I expect that that I then have this QCD-like model that has this rho and A1 resonances, and I couple the currents, so in that case, the technical currents, to a set of HV plus U1 gauge fields. And what happens is that these fields should be the ones that hit the Goldson boson, so the pi that I had before. And that's it. The other ones shouldn't be changed. I should still keep my Techni rho, Techni A1, have more or less the same mass. So I should find that in the end, let's say the mass of the W should be G squared, where I still have to define G squared, but the 4D gauge coupling times the pi decay constant with some factor. And I would like to see that the KK modes, that I can still recognize my KK modes of QCD, let's say, in the technical side. So I should still be able to identify the technical and technique. So if everything is changed by this change of boundary conditions, then I'm not going to be able to do that. The point is that if I look at warped spaces, even if the boundary condition is changed like this, I can still do this identification. So I will be able to still identify the technical technique one. I will still be able to recognize that the Goldson bosons are eaten by only the lightest mode, and to write the equivalent of this relation. So that's what I'll try to explain quickly. So I don't want to do that. Right, so I first want to show that, so I'll discuss this quickly. I want to show that I can recognize the curves I can, that they are essentially the same. So for this, I'm going to look at modes that are normalizable. The point is, when I'm talking about this warped matrix, I'm thinking of a matrix where this would diverge as a zero goes to zero. Okay. So the point is that this has an impact on your normalization of states. Now if I have the norm of the state, if you want, is what you have to introduce the 5D gauge coupling to have something that is dimensionless. It's going to be something like this, times the wave function squared. So if I look at the modes for which this is finite, so I'm thinking now of resetting L0 equal to 0. Then what have I done? I've just changed now the boundary conditions from minus in the UV to plus. Well, if you look at this, if I want this to be finite when this diverges, I'm going to find that, in fact, even the modes with plus boundary conditions vanish on the UV brain. Okay, so in fact, they also have a minus boundary condition. So if I'm now looking in this warp matrix at wave functions that have a plus boundary condition, I end up finding that, in fact, I already know them. They are the ones with minus boundary condition that I have computed before in QC. So to some approximation. Will there be corrections to this? Zero is not equal to zero. So in other words, the wave function that I've computed before, the Techni rho and of the the rho and the A1, are now the same functions I will find when I'm looking at the Techni rho and the Techni A1. Okay? Up to small corrections. And the corrections come from the fact that now I'm going to ask for the first two components. I'm not looking at the third component because there's the mixing with the U1 B minus step, so I don't want to get into that now. I'm imposing these boundary conditions. So this is the plus boundary condition that I'm talking about. And the other one stays a minus. So what happens is that I'm always combining vector and axial wave functions to get an eigenmode. But essentially, I can describe this as saying that there's a mode that looks like the Techni rho in the sense that it has a large vector component here, but a very small axial one. And the vector component looks like the solution that I had for the rho before. So I can draw them if you want. I can unfold my space that I had before. I had the UV brain, and I had left and right, or V and A fields, and the infrared brain here. Now let's say I unfold this like this, and I look at the vector and axial wave function like this. So the UV brain is in the middle, and I've constructed the things as if I had two infrared brains. So what's the wave function of the Techni rho? It's something that goes on the atmosphere. It's something that goes like this and then stays nearly zero.
So the axial part is nearly zero, and the vector part is exactly the wave function that I had for the row. Okay, so my technique was just built by having the wave function of the technique row and a vanishing axial wave function combined here to respect this. So there are small corrections because of this when zero is different from zero. And for the axial, if I use the same representation, the technique A1 will be something like this, where here it respects the boundary condition that I had before. So, and this bit is exactly the wave function of the A1, and I just completed by this nearly vanishing bit, so nearly vanishing vector component, to get the technique A1. So my computation of the masses of before goes through, I can use it, and to get the some combinations of masses and couplings of these technique row and technique A1s.
So I'm not going to do that again.
One important point is that since whether the fields have plus or minus boundary conditions in the UV, in fact, they're the same. They have minus boundary conditions anyway, essentially. They're not very sensitive to what you've imposed there. Meaning that when I do the third component and I get, and things are a bit more complicated because of the U1B minus L, I have slightly different boundary conditions in the UV, but it doesn't change my wave functions and it doesn't change the masses. So in other words, the resonances are isospin symmetric. The only effect of having my B minus L VH field is to add another set of current sections. So this is not the whole spectrum. Well, the point here is to say that I already know some of the resonances. They are the heavy ones, it turns out. And they're the same as before. So I can construct them using the previous one. But there's a set of other fields that are called that I call ultralight because their masses are much smaller. And why are their masses much smaller? Well, because they're precisely the modes that were not normalizable when a zero goes to zero. So let's say the norm would be something like this and would diverge when I send a zero to zero. So when I send a Mach-Mathrin field. And what does this have to do with their masses? Well, it means that this term grows and explodes, whereas the term that gives them their masses is something like this, comes from the fifth derivative of the wave function square. This one is not going to diverge. So I have to then to rescale the fields and to get a kinetic term that is normalized because it was huge, and then I get a very small mass term. So I'm going to find always that the mass of these modes is much smaller than the mass of the curve of that kind, which is given by 1 over L1 squared, essentially. Okay. Well, that's good, because that means I can even find an approximation to their wave function. The wave function I'm going to satisfy, this is approximately 0.
So in normal language, what would I identify these modes with?
I shouldn't say that. Yeah, the W. Yeah. Which is much lighter than...
So these are the W?
Yeah. And it's the W because I'm going to show that it has essentially eaten the pine, well, the technique. So, well, it's obvious in a sense because I'm saying I want to solve this equal to zero. And I did that before. I told you that the solution was either constant if I had plus boundary condition in the UV and plus in infrared. But if I had a minus boundary condition in the infrared, which is the case for the axial component, well, then the solution is this alpha that I had given the expression before. But the point is that does it solve the boundary condition here in the UV? That should be a plus for the fields I'm looking at. Well, it does, because in fact, the derivative of alpha was 1 over the Wobb factor, and this goes to 0 in the ultralight, meaning that the derivative of my wave function vanishes on the UV brain, or approximately at least. So I solve the boundary conditions up to small corrections. So I know the wave function of the W. In the same diagram, so I need to write the axial and spectral component. So the vector component, I know the result is a constant, so let's say 1. And then here, because I solve to respect the right boundary condition for the V minus A combination, in fact, I should probably am drawing V and here minus A, then here it continues into alpha, and this matching is okay. To corrections when L0 is different from 0. So it's an approximate solution. And this is the shape of the function alpha. So I know the wave function, and I can solve iteratively because I know I can also determine its mass, so I should explain it. I can determine the mass of the W independently of the metric. Like here, I could solve for this independently of the metric. Alpha is given in terms of the metric, and I don't have to solve some any differential equation or anything. I know the wave function analytically if it's simple enough, otherwise numerically, but without having to solve anything. And I can also find the mass of the W because, as I just said, it's much lighter than the others. So it means that the sum of the inverse of all the masses of all the Kazakhine is essentially just the inverse of the W mass. And this I can use the techniques of before to compute that this is some integral, some double integral over the log factors, blah, blah, blah. So I don't do this here because it's slightly more complicated because the boundary conditions are a bit different. But you would find a result. And so you can get order by order also approximations to the W mass. Order by order in the ratio precisely of the mass of the W over the mass of the other Kazakhine. And if you do things correctly, you see that this is the coefficient that appears in front of the kinetic term of the gauge field. So this is essentially 1 over the 4D gauge coupling. And you will find that this is approximately G4D times the Coulton boson decay constant, as expected, meaning that the W has eaten the pi, essentially, I find the wave function of the pi in the W, so that's not really surprising. And I can even check that I get the right relation that it's, oh, sorry, it's 1 over, that its mass is given by the standard expression of the field that is just coupled to Coulton bosons, and whether the decay constant or the Coulton boson is given. So this one is approximate, and in fact it's not true that only the W eats the pi, eats the Coulton boson. All the other modes also get contributions to their masses that come from the Coulton boson. And you can extract an exact relation, which is that the Fermi constant, which is again some contribution given by some, well, it's precisely what I was talking about before. It's a four Fermi interaction that results from integrating out all the Kazakhline and the W. And this one you will find is strictly given in terms of the pi and k constant with the right factor or whatever. Meaning that this one is exact, so when you take into account all Kazakhines, you see that they have all together have eaten the pi. That's why you find a pi here. But essentially it's just the W that has eaten it. That's why you find this approximate relation. So in a sense, I now understand if the metric is well, I understand how my 5D model describes holographic technicolor in terms of what I knew about holographic QCD. I have let the rule A1 become the techni rule. I don't know how to write a rule T and A1 T. I just have to change the scale, like change my confinement scale A1. And the pine disappears and it's eaten to give the mass W and Z, which I haven't discussed, giving the right the relations that I expected. And the spectrum of these guys is unchanged. So I can go on and compute things. I know how to identify the number of colors there. And I can even go further. But I guess I don't have much time for that. So I think I'll stop.
What is the excuse me, what is the mass of the first excited graviton in this model?
Well, you'd have to solve the equation these boundary problems for the for spin 2. So we haven't done that here.
I mean, is it likely to be very high or very low or what?
No. I don't think it has any reason to be very high.
Some number of order 2 over L1.
So then you have to look at its coupling.
So how is that related to the mass of the W? I mean, is it?
Well, it's the same order.
Same order as the
technical. Oh, sorry, it's a technical. The first Kazakhine.
Right, so in other words, not particularly low or anything.
No,
and,
no.
And that's because the L0 is large, I guess, somehow related.
Is this one
same? I mean, is zero. I'm sorry, the L0 is zero, so the curvature K over here is large,
yeah.
So.
It's mostly sensitive to L1.
I don't think it does much. Yeah. Yeah. No, the same as here. So in QCD, I could get completely rid of L0s. And
yeah,
zero,
right. I guess in the
change.
Limit of L0 goes to 0, it just gets set by something else.
Yeah, which is just L1. And if L0 is not 0, but more compared to L1, doesn't, I mean, it changes the exact number of L1.
I guess you need the finite L0 only for the W.
Right, yeah. Otherwise, this one is not normalizable.
Yeah, it's given by this integral.
Yeah. Well, in fact, this is the last one that I didn't want to explain more.
So I think in the work case that integral is giving you the log.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, this is maybe something I should have mentioned that here. So I can talk about this in general, whatever the metric, but in cases of interest, if I want to make contact with a fairly strongly interacting theory, I would like to identify the two-point function as before, and identify this log and the prefactor as a number of colors. So probably this integral gives me a log. So the suppression factor that I expand in here, which is nw squared over the mass of the Kaiser kinds squared, is the log, or part of the log. The log of the ratio of the two positions of the brain.
What was your last thing?
No, it's a bit too long.
Okay, let's thank Johannes again.